BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, it's UKIP's candidate for Mayor of Bristol, Paul Turner. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the Daily Express is also floating, as we've been doing for many years, the theory the Twin Towers were brought down by bombs on 9/11. We have a renowned 9/11 author in to discuss that. Also, we go to Rotterdam and hear concern about the Bilderbergers from there. And what's the Russian view of the Bilderberg meetings, the Bilderberg conferences, where all these budding politicians get together with Henry Kissinger, effectively a kind of vetting process for who's going to be allowed to succeed in politics? We ask him, is Vladimir Putin just another global gangster like the rest of them? Also, Unser Politics blog from Germany. They have been looking at the privatisation of the police, the civil service and the army, legislation that's been quietly going through the European Parliament in Brussels. Plus, Martin Summers' weekly chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour. After 6 o'clock, onto our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and mostly dry. This weekend, highs up to 21, sunshine and thunderous heavy showers on Saturday, longer spells of rain on Sunday. Next week, highs again 21 Celsius, plenty of sunny spells and also some patchy rain. Next weekend, the 2nd and 3rd of July, highs of 16 Celsius, sunshine and heavy showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And I think before we start, Martin, I'm going to ask you just quickly, do you think that the thunder and lightning there was in London, anything to do with the Brexit vote on yesterday?
No.
Well, because there was something similar happened in Greece, wasn't it, when they had their referendum last summer? Lots of thunderstorms and portents.
Yeah, because thunderstorms.
Portents of doom.
Thunderstorms happen in the summer, Tony. That's the kind of time of year they do.
Well, just pure coincidence then. Also joined on the line by Paul Turner. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
Paul, can you just give us your immediate reaction to the result? Because it's actually quite a narrow one, isn't it?
Yes, in reality, we do have to sort of accept the fact that it's only a 4%, near enough 4% difference. But it's very pleasing, and I think that certainly the politicians of our country, I think, will hopefully now stand up and realise that maybe they've not actually been listening to the people particularly well over the last several years.
What do you think are the main reasons why people have decided to vote out rather than in?
I think it's been quite a mixture of reasons. I think for some people, the situation reference uncontrolled immigration has obviously been at the top of a lot of people's list. But I think for myself, sort of, certainly over the last couple of weeks when I've been speaking to people who have maybe been undecided, the one thing that's really come out is that I think a lot of people don't think that there's actually been a pro-Remain campaign. All they've seen is a pro-Leave and an anti-Leave campaign. And I think also that some of the threats that came out from Osborne and Cameron over the last sort of week or so, I think galvanised a few people who, again, might have been teetering on the I'm not too sure to say, well, no, I'm not going to accept that. But I think there's been a whole variety of real reasons. I don't think anybody can put their finger on any one thing, really.
Martin Summers, you're a Remainer. What do you make of why people have voted the way they did? And did they vote wrong?
Well, obviously, I didn't want this result, otherwise I wouldn't have voted Remain. The fact is, as Paul says, there's a variety of reasons. I mean, there's some people on the left who voted for Leave. That will, you know, if you think about the closeness of the result, those kind of people may have made quite a difference. So, you know, it's not straightforwardly left and right on this issue, is it?
There has been pretty much a split. Older people voting Leave, younger people voting Remain. And a lot of younger people saying, actually, well, we're not voting between 18, 25-year-olds. A lot of them just decided they didn't want to, they don't see any point in voting. Maybe they just don't understand the issues, or they're leaving it to the older people.
Well, I think we'll obviously people will be analysing the results over the next few days, but the obvious take-homes immediately is that Scotland voted for Remain, and also Northern Ireland, which means that quite a lot of loyalists must have voted for Remain, which is potentially a positive feature there. You know, you've got a consensus there that they wanted to remain, but of course it opens all sorts of questions about the border, etc., etc. And of course all this uncertainty is what's causing the problems in the British markets and the international markets.
Looking at the results, there's quite a good breakdown of the regional results on the Daily Telegraph website, and I'm just seeing the various cities going, starting from the most voting most Remain and the regions voting most Remain to the ones voting the most Leave finally. So the most Remain was nearly 60% versus 40% in London. Then in Northern Ireland, 55.7% pro-Remain. Then in the southeast, we start to get over to the other side where there's more pro-leavers, and that's the whole of the southeast region, not just London, 51.8%. I suppose one of the real surprises is the Wales, 52.5% for Leave. And I wonder, Paul, what you make of that, because there's been a lot of pushing in the campaign. I mean, you can pick up the BBC Wales here, and you've been hearing them week after week talking about all those lovely EU subsidies that are going to go if Wales and the rest of Britain leaves the European Union, but they seem to have gone for Leave anyway.
I must admit, I think probably both sides of the campaign would have to admit that that's probably a surprise, the way Wales has gone there. Again, I think the reality of people starting to understand that the subsidies, etc., that come from Europe are own money that has gone there and come back. And it's not actually really money from the European Union as such. But I also think that the inability of the government to do a great deal, reference the steelworks in Port Talbot as an example, and the government have virtually admitted that their hands were tied to some extent by the European Union. And I think that you know, Wales is a very, very proud nation, and I think that they're probably quite determined to not so much buck the trend, but they're a very proud nation, and they don't like the idea of people so far away making decisions that their elected government can't counter. And I think more and more people, certainly across Wales, were starting to get that feeling that there's something wrong with that concept in the first place.
Yeah, well, I've called it a kind of Brussels machine, really. It's not so much something that we can have any real influence over. In the southwest, moving down, the next highest on the Leave side is the southwest, which is 52.6%. The northwest, 53.7%. The east of England, I guess that's kind of East Anglia, 56.5%. Yorkshire and Humber, 57.7%. So they're going up kind of towards the 60-40 threshold, which is pretty much where we get when we get to the West Midlands, the North East, Yorkshire and Humber. Martin, all these, mostly the places which are particularly pro-Leave, are the places where they've seen employment prospects really plummeting, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, there are reasons why people will have voted for Leave, but of course the game now begins. Is there not? I mean, when the experts, like the Bank of England, Mark Carney, and all these other people say there's going to be a price, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, writing in the Telegraph, who said I'm a Brexiter, but if people think it's going to be costless, they're deluding themselves, because freedom ain't free. Ireland didn't get freedom from the United Kingdom without sacrifice, and Britain is not going to get out of this without sacrifice. And of course, we're now plunging the whole of the European Union into a crisis, which plunges the international financial system into a crisis, which is based in the City of London. And in fact, what we should have been talking about since 2008 is the fact that the banks are insolvent. We've been talking about moving the deck chairs around on the Titanic. So the deck chairs have been moved from one side of the Titanic to the other, but now we've hit the iceberg.
Looks like the iceberg. Yeah, the iceberg. We've hit the iceberg, and now something is going to happen rather than not.
It is.
See, but I mean, in a way, you see, you've been pushing for this for years, saying we've got to have a sense of reality in the financial markets.
Well, we have, but I think most people didn't realise how serious this was going to be. People on the inside of the financial markets knew that it had the potential to rip it all down, but most people presume that the Tory government has somehow fixed the financial markets. Yes, they haven't.
We've had a slide, bit of a slide today, but let's look at the... we've looked at England and Wales. What about Scotland and Northern Ireland? Because Northern Ireland... the result in Scotland was 38% leave, 62%, the highest of all of them, was for a pro-Remain vote in Scotland. But Northern Ireland's coming fairly close to that, 55.7 versus 44.3% in Northern Ireland, and the Remainers have it there. Now, I mean, the obvious thing is that the Northern Ireland might start thinking, well, maybe we'd be better off with the Southern Irish.
You're asking me? Well, no, I mean, I don't think it's, you know, it certainly creates problems for politics over there in one sense. But in another sense, the fact that there was a consensus between both communities that they wanted to remain is also a potential building block for the future. So it's, but it you know, the United Kingdom probably won't be here in 2 years' time. That's one of the effects of what we're seeing.
Paul, is that the effect of all your campaigning to get out of the European Union, that we're going to lose the United Kingdom?
No, not at all. I mean, the fact that Scotland has been whispering about freedom, as they'd like to put it, for many, many years. I don't think this particular referendum has a massive impact on that. You'll find that you know, the SNP would be waiting for their moment to want another referendum. If we'd even voted to remain, they'd still be waiting for their moment to spring that request. I think what this has done is certainly from a Northern Irish point of view, which again, I'm not sure if that was a buck in the trend a little bit, but I think it is very interesting, as Martin said, it does kind of indicate that from a Northern Irish point of view, there does seem to be a little bit more of a coming together from all sides of the community there with the same thought process. If that means that Northern Ireland might think about wanting to become part of the Republic, I think that's a very, very big step to be taking, or to even be thinking about from a Northern Ireland point of view.
Well, it's interesting. I'm just thinking from a unionist point of view, one is surprised that as a unionist majority in Northern Ireland, that they would be more loyal to Brussels than they would be to Westminster.
Well, again, I think to understand whether that statement is wholly accurate, I think we have to look very, very carefully at how both the Leave and the Remain campaign was carried out in Northern Ireland. I personally don't know how well one campaign went across as opposed to the other. It might well be that in Northern Ireland, the Remain campaign got it right, but in most of England and Wales, they got it wrong. It could be something as simple as that. I do think, where Northern Ireland is concerned, that if you start talking in terms of breaking away from the United Kingdom, then I think that would be a very, very different question. Because if you think that the Remain option is remaining part of the United Kingdom, part of European Union.
I suppose the option might be for the Northern Irish, if Scotland votes in the future to leave the United Kingdom, then Northern Ireland might do the same at a similar time. Well, we'll see. None of us have got a crystal ball that can quite work that one out. But anyway, let's have a listen now, because as was widely predicted on this programme, I have to say, whatever the result was going to be, David Cameron did announce his resignation today, although he'll be staying in office until there's a new leader, which almost certainly looks as was also predicted on this show back in October last year, that Boris will be taking over, because the BBC give him always pride of place as the first person to talk after the leader's speech at the party conferences. And of course they did exactly the same today with the announcement of the resignation. The first person you pretty much hear on the radio and the TV on the BBC is Boris. You know, the political correspondents all seem to tip him And so let's have a listen now anyway to David Cameron speaking on the Brexit result for the referendum today.
Okay.
The British people have voted to leave the European Union, and their will must be respected. I want to thank everyone who took part in the campaign on my side of the argument, including all those who put aside party differences to speak in what they believed was the national interest. And let me congratulate all those who took part in the Leave campaign for the spirited and passionate case that they made. The will of the British people is an instruction that must be delivered. It was not a decision that was taken lightly, not least because so many things were said by so many different organisations about the significance of this decision. So there can be no doubt about the result. Across the world, people have been watching the choice that Britain has made. I would reassure those markets and investors that Britain's economy is fundamentally strong. And I would also reassure Brits living in European countries and European citizens living here that there will be no immediate changes in your circumstances. There will be no initial change in the way our people can travel, in the way our goods can move, or the way our services can be sold. We must now prepare for a negotiation with the European Union. This will need to involve the full engagement of the Scottish, Welsh, and Northern Ireland governments to ensure that the interests of all parts of our United Kingdom are protected and advanced. But above all, this will require strong, determined, and committed leadership. I'm very proud and very honoured to have been Prime Minister of this country for 6 years. I believe we've made great steps, with more people in work than ever before in our history, with reforms to welfare and education, increasing people's life chances, building a bigger and stronger society, keeping our promises to the poorest people in the world, and enabling those who love each other to get married, whatever their sexuality. But above all, restoring Britain's economic strength. And I'm grateful to everyone who's helped to make that happen. I've also always believed that we have to confront big decisions, not duck them. That is why we delivered the first coalition government in 70 years to bring our economy back from the brink. It's why we delivered a fair, legal, and decisive referendum in Scotland. And it's why I made the pledge to renegotiate Britain's position in the European Union and to hold a referendum on our membership, and have carried those things out. I fought this campaign in the only way I know how, which is to say directly and passionately what I think and feel, head, heart and soul. I held nothing back. I was absolutely clear about my belief that Britain is stronger, safer and better off inside the European Union. And I made clear the referendum was about this and this alone, not the future of any single politician, including myself. But the British people have made a very clear decision to take a different path. And as such, I think the country requires fresh leadership to take it in this direction. I will do everything I can as Prime Minister to steady the ship over the coming weeks and months. But I do not think it would be right for me to try to be the captain that steers our country to its next destination. This is not a decision I've taken lightly, but I do believe it's in the national interest to have a period of stability and then the new leadership required. There is no need for a precise timetable today, but in my view we should aim to have a new Prime Minister in place by the start of the Conservative Party conference in October. Delivering stability will be important, and I will continue in post as Prime Minister with my Cabinet for the next 3 months. The Cabinet will meet on Monday. The Governor of the Bank of England is making a statement about the steps that the Bank and the Treasury are taking to reassure financial markets. We will also continue taking forward the important legislation that we set before Parliament in the Queen's speech. And I've spoken to Her Majesty the Queen this morning to advise her of the steps that I'm taking. A negotiation with the European Union will need to begin under a new Prime Minister. And I think it's right that this new Prime Minister takes the decision about when to trigger Article 50 and start the formal and legal process of leaving the EU. I will attend the European Council next week to explain the decision the British people have taken and my own decision. The British people have made a choice that not only needs to be respected, but those on the losing side of the argument, myself included, should help to make it work. Britain is a special country. We have so many great advantages. A parliamentary democracy where we resolve great issues about our future through peaceful debate. A great trading nation with our science and arts, our engineering and our creativity, respected the world over. And while we are not perfect, I do believe we can be a model of a multiracial, multi-faith democracy where people can come and make a contribution and rise to the very highest that their talent allows. Although leaving Europe was not the path I recommended, I am the first to praise our incredible strengths. I've said before that Britain can survive outside the European Union, and indeed that we could find a way. Now the decision has been made to leave, we need to find the best way. And I will do everything I can to help. I love this country, and I feel honoured to have served it. And I will do everything I can in future to help this great country succeed. Thank you very much.
That was the Prime Minister speaking this morning after the announcement of the referendum being for a Brexit, not for a Remain. Martin, what did you make of that speech there? I mean, he's talking particularly, I wonder what you make about this thing about it not triggering Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, waiting until a few more months. So I suppose it means that Cameron can go along to some more EU meetings still before they have a new Prime Minister.
Well, it's all damage limitation, isn't it? Damage limitation politically for himself and the Conservative Party, but also damage limitation in terms of the national interest. So, I mean, the problem with the vote is that it's not actually clear what we are going to end up with. Are we going to be in the same halfway house as Switzerland and Norway, who are basically part of the single market and therefore have to accept free movement of labour, for example? But that means that they don't face tariff barriers on their exports, although they do have to pay into the European budget and they don't get any money out of it. That's one model. The other model is complete break with Europe. But then, of course, are we going to sign the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership? I say no, but many Tory MPs who voted for Brexit believe in the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is supposedly tying the European Union and America together in one free trade association. So all of these questions have not been answered. And in fact, it's not even clear that the Brexiters themselves know what it is amongst themselves, they want to do.
I'll tell you what many of the Brexiters will be saying is, we don't know where we're heading with the EU anyway, because we don't have anywhere near enough input. Anyway, what did you make, Paul? What did you make of the speech from David Cameron there?
Well, I think firstly, it was obviously a very eloquent and emotional speech from him. So I think it was a very genuine speech from him as well. I think the points to take from it are the positive points of how he feels Britain can actually not only survive but grow and prosper outside the European Union. There are, and Martin's quite right to mention, there are question marks over exactly what our relationship with the European Union will be once we do actually split, which could well be in a number of years' time, 2 or 3 years' time, possibly. And I think that is the key point, is that it's so important now for our political leaders of all parties and our politicians, our MPs, and even local politicians, to actually start, instead of trying to negotiate this, is to actually start communicating more with the people. Because I think there's been a big surprise here. I think that the odds favourite was to remain, although it's only a small margin, relatively, I think it's a big upset. And I think it's down, and our politicians need to start understanding. They need to start listening to the people of this country, because this is democracy working. This is the people of the country telling our leaders that the direction that they were taking us is not the direction that the people of this country wanted to go in. Now, that doesn't mean to say that the next direction that the Conservatives might want to take us is the right direction that the people want us to take. Want to go in, But I do think that somewhere between now and the time we do formally exit the European Union in maybe 2 years' time or so, I do believe that it's of the utmost importance that our politicians start talking a lot more with the people on the street and actually finding out what the real people actually want from our country and where they want it to be.
Well, I mean, one of the bits that's been kept, I mean, I think this is fair to say it's been deliberately kept out of the news, is around about a week and a half ago, the Swiss withdrew their EU application. Swiss MPs was quoted as saying only lunatics would join it now. He agreed that Britain wouldn't get the same deal as the Swiss post-Brexit. He said, no, you'd get a much better deal. His conclusion, yeah. I think if you, Britain, leave the EU, it will be very good for you, Paul.
Well, I think there's been an awful lot that's been withheld from the point of view of the media and from the point of view of the British people. And the first time, this morning was the first time I'd heard the BBC actually start talking about the extremely high level of anti-EU feeling that there is across the whole of the European Union. And I think it was Andrew Neil who was saying that the anti-EU feeling in France is much, much stronger than it is in Britain, and they've got a general election next year. It's very strong in Germany. They've got a general election next year. Pound for a penny that those two countries, the parties that win, are going to be the parties that are going to offer the people an in-out referendum. Now, can you imagine the European Union without not only the UK, but without Germany and France? We've also got Poland, Austria, Hungary. We know the problems with Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal. They're all queuing up, and Denmark, they're all queuing up to have their referendum to get out. That is how good this club is for the people of Europe. The vast majority of them are now wanting to get out of it. So fundamentally, people have to start understanding it is a failed project, and although it'll continue, and I believe it will continue for some years to come, I reckon over the next 2 years, we'll see most of the biggest contributors into the European Union wanting out. And that will be the start of a stampede to get out of it. And then we'll start seeing the real level of financial corruption that's been in the European Union. The total lack of democracy in there will start coming out, because it'll just crumble.
Well, I think it's worth looking at how we got here historically. I mean, some would say, and Boris Johnson himself said, didn't he, that Hitler wanted to have some kind of big controlling power over the whole of Europe. And in fact, he's quite right in some ways, because in 1943, the Nazis issued something called the Europäische Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft, which is the right. European Economic Community. But that was actually during the war. They issued that in Berlin. But the first, I suppose, vestiges of what we now know as the EU was the European Coal and Steel Community in 1952. Then in 1958, the Treaty of Rome was signed, which was the EEC, the creation of the European Economic Community, started by countries like Italy, West Germany and France. And then in 1973, Britain joined. In 1975, we had a referendum here in Britain where the people said OK. And that was because Britain joined under Ted Heath, under Conservative government. But they only got a referendum 2 years later under Harold Wilson, a Labour government, in 1975. And we ratified the earlier decision from 2 years ago to join. And then in 1990, we had a run-up to the Maastricht Treaty, because Margaret Thatcher was saying, I'm not having this. Basically, I'm not handing over this sovereign nation to 13 unelected bankers. And in 1990, there was a leadership challenge to her, and she was removed. John Major came in at that point as a Conservative leader, who he then went on, didn't he, to go onto the board of the Carlyle Group, I think, which is a funder of many of the big arms companies. And in 1992, the Maastricht Treaty was signed, which was how the European Union itself was formed. Then we started electing MEPs to the European Parliament. But still, the European Commission, which does most of the introduction of new laws, that kind of thing, is still appointees. And most of them are failed politicians, people who've failed in public life for whatever reason, have been voted out by members of the public. So there's a little quick kind of point, but I don't know if you've got anything to add to that, Martin, as a sort of look since World War II of how the European Union in Brussels has formed.
The European Union is also part of the what you might call Euro-Atlantic integration with NATO. And taking up what Paul was just saying about how other countries are going to line up to demand referendums, he's right. In Greece, of course, what they should have done is to leave the euro and cancel their own debts, because that's what you can do. If you leave the European Union, you can say, right, all that money that you say we owe, we're not going to pay it. But, of course, that would have collapsed Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank is the most important bank in Germany, and they are the most exposed in the international derivatives market. So the real fear now in the markets is as France, Italy, Greece line up for a rerun of getting out of the euro, although the Greeks didn't want to leave the European Union, they just want to leave the euro, then Deutsche Bank will go down. The German economy will follow it, and then our economy will follow that.
Are you saying
and at the other end of that, we're going to have another Marshall Plan or something like that to rebuild the world economy. We'll need change in the United States
like
of America
Roosevelt's
for that.
New Deal or something like
well,
that.
Well, we're, don't forget the Japanese stock market took a hit this morning when this vote came through. Southeast Asian markets...
incredibly shaky anyway.
Well, that's because the whole thing is a house of cards, and that's what nobody's been talking about. Everybody's been talking about the Brussels bureaucrats decide that... I tell you who decides things in Western Europe, it's NATO. And NATO is run by the United States and the British, which is why Nigel Farage, for example, quite rightly pointed out that the European Union was being used to provoke Russia in Ukraine and also in Syria. And that big stuff is coming over the horizon long before all these details
Martin,
are teased out.
What you're saying, though, is that Deutsche Bank are basically the biggest suicide bombers in the room.
Well, no, they're all of these banks are actually on the edge of collapse. And something like this,
suicide bombers, what I mean is that they are threatening governments. They're saying, well, look, you're going to have to do this, otherwise we collapse.
Well, what's been happening all along is they've been saying, if you don't do what we want, i.e. bail us out, that we will collapse and you will go down with us. But what we've now done, after the years since the financial crisis, is governments have no more resources to bail banks out. It's one of the things that's been absolutely kicked into touch is the reprivatisation of the nationalised British banks. Their shares went down this morning catastrophically. There's no time they're going to be sold back to the private sector anytime soon. So we're going to be picking that tab up. Now, as we go forward, speaking as an economist, and all the top economists did say all this, but people didn't hear it, this is going to be a tsunami. And it's not because of Brexit, it's because of the banking system, the stuff we haven't been talking about for 8 years because we've been talking about Brexit.
Yeah, finally, it's going to hit ground zero, a kind of reality where it's been
indeed
in cuckoo land. Anyway, Paul, look, I don't know if you want to comment on that, but also on my little timeline that I did of the evolution, if you can call it that, of the European EU Brussels machine.
Yeah, I think the timeline is quite accurate. But yeah, a very quick question to Martin. I think you're absolutely right that the time bomb that's been ticking is not about the UK leaving the European Union. It's not even about the European Union, for all intents and purposes, dissipating. It is, you're absolutely right, a banking issue that we didn't learn from in 2008, or our governments didn't learn from and didn't act and didn't deal with properly then, and it's been going on for many, many decades. And the reason I'm so happy that this has happened now is because if we'd remained in the European Union, that time bomb would have just continued to tick and get much, much bigger. At the moment, and this is something that really, if in 2008 we decided to leave the European Union, then the time bomb would have been a much, much smaller time bomb. But the problem now, it's been allowed to grow and grow and grow. And if we'd remained in the European Union, that would have grown and grown and grown and continued to grow. At least now what we're finding, and there might be an element of pain attached to it. I know Martin mentioned a big tsunami. But the thing is, that tsunami is going to happen. Whether it happens now or in 10 or 20 years' time, it's going to happen. The difference is, if we left it to happen in 10 years' time or in 20 years' time, it'll be so, so much bigger and so, so much more painful than if it happens now. And you're absolutely right. The problems we're seeing around Europe and indeed around the world have been created by the banks. And you mentioned the Deutsche Bank, the big German bank. They're central to the big problems that have happened and that are still happening across the world. And you know, we need to have this tsunami so that we can get it over and done with, and then we can start rebuilding our country and our future for our children without that tsunami hanging round their necks. And that's the big problem if we'd remain, is that tsunami would still be happening, and it might be 5, 10, 15 years down the road, but it would still happen, but it would be so, so much bigger when it did.
Well, someone who will be, I imagine, steering that whole process through, and hopefully in his first day of office, invoking this Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty and stopping sending any of the British diplomats, etc., to Brussels to do their work there, is Boris Johnson. And as I've been saying on this show for, well over, not quite a year, at least about 10 months or so, is almost certain to become the next leader of the Conservative Party, largely, it seems, because of his Bullingdon Club connections and his establishment connections. And maybe he even didn't want to stand as mayor again because of London, because of this. You know, he's been slated for this, and this is the way it seems to me the establishment works. You know, they've already decided years ahead who they want to be our next Prime Minister, and they put them in that position for us to vote for them. But anyway, we haven't actually voted for Boris to be Prime Minister, but anyway, it looks like he will be anyway. So let's hear from him now speaking this morning.
Thank you very much, Gisela. And I want to begin this morning by paying tribute to David Cameron, who has spoken earlier from Downing Street. And I know I speak for Michael in saying how sad I am that he has decided to step down, but obviously I respect that decision. I've known David Cameron for a very long time, and I believe he's been one of the most extraordinary politicians of our age. A brave and principled man who's given superb leadership of his party and his country for many years. Reforming our public services, delivering one nation conservative government, making this country the most dynamic economy in Europe, and with his own brand of compassionate conservatism that rightly earned his party the first majority government for decades. It was his bravery that gave this country the first referendum on the European Union for 43 years, the first time that many of us have had the chance to vote explicitly on this question. Today, I think all of us politicians should thank the British people, because in a way they have been doing our job for us. They hire us to deal with the hard questions, and this year we gave them one of the biggest and toughest questions of all. Some people are now saying that was wrong, and that the people should never have been asked in this way. I disagree. I believe it was entirely right and inevitable, and indeed that there is no way of dealing with a decision on this scale except by putting it to the people. Because in the end, this question is about the people. It's about the right of the people of this country to settle their own destiny. It's about the very principles of our democracy. The rights of all of us to elect and remove the people who make the key decisions in their lives. And I think that the electorate have searched in their hearts and answered as honestly as they can. And as Gisela says, in a poll on a scale the like of which we have never seen before in this country, they have decided that it is time to vote to take back control. From a European Union that has become too remote, too opaque, and not accountable enough to the people it is meant to serve. In voting to leave the EU, it is vital to stress that there is now no need for haste, and indeed, as the Prime Minister has just said, nothing will change over the short term, except that work will have to begin on how to give effect to the will of the people and to extricate this country from the supranational system. And as the Prime Minister has rightly said, there is no need to invoke Article 50. And to those who may be anxious, whether at home or abroad, this does not mean that the United Kingdom will be in any way less united
nor indeed does it mean that it will be any less European. And I want to speak to the millions of people, directly to the millions of people who did not vote for this outcome, especially young people, who may feel that this decision in some way involves pulling up a drawbridge or any kind of isolationism, because I think the very opposite is true. We cannot turn our backs on Europe. We are part of Europe. Our children and our grandchildren will continue to have a wonderful future as Europeans, travelling to the continent, understanding the languages and cultures that make up our common European civilization, continuing to interact with the peoples of other countries in a way that is open and friendly and outward looking. And I want to reassure everybody that, in my view, as a result of this, Britain will continue to be a great European power, leading discussions on foreign policy and defence and intelligence sharing and all the work that currently goes on to make our world safer. But there is simply no need in the 21st century to be part of a federal system of government based in Brussels that is imitated nowhere else on earth. It was a noble idea for its time. It is no longer right for this country. And it is the essence of our case that young people in this country can look forward to a more secure and more prosperous future.
That's Boris Johnson speaking. I think we managed to cut off the tail end of his speech there. But Martin, what do you make of that? I mean, he's being very conciliatory, really, I think, and saying, well, look, this isn't what you think it is. It's some kind of rude up yours to the rest of Europe. We're saying, well, actually, we just want to take a different direction.
Well, I mean, obviously, can we pair it with what Cameron said earlier? They're both playing the game of damage limitation. The question is whether the feral traders in the foreign exchange markets are going to see it that way.
I mean, that's always going to be the case with democracy,
it is.
Isn't it?
Yes,
people
it is.
Make a decision which isn't always in line with the city, what the city
wants. No. And what happened in Greece is very instructive, isn't it? Where the people voted overwhelmingly against the austerity being imposed by Schäuble and the Bundesbank, but they were overruled. And Varoufakis actually left the Greek government because they weren't prepared to carry out their threat and leave the euro, which would have involved them cancelling their debts. Countries can just walk away from their debts, and that's what happened in the 1930s. Every single Latin American country walked away from their debts, and we're going to go there. And, of course, that's going to crash all the banks, which is going to get rid of everybody's pensions. It's nothing to do with Brexit. This is what's been there all along, coming back to what Paul was saying earlier. I'm afraid we might have been able to manage this better. Once you've bailed the banks out, you've got to restructure them, and that's what didn't happen, because they were too politically powerful. They used the bailout money in the US and in Europe and in Britain to basically buy the politicians so that nothing serious was done since 2008. Now there will be a crash. But the only way out of that will be to build international financial...
You've been saying this since 2000.
Well, I know, but I mean, the crash has only happened once by the nature of the beast. I think this is big enough to cause a crash, especially because, as Paul pointed out, other countries in the European Union are now going to take this as a precedent. And the traders know that.
But at the end of the day, surely, and maybe you can answer this one, Paul, surely the banks and the City of London should be there to serve the needs of the public if you were living in a democratic society.
Yeah, but we're not.
Well, that's a difficult one to deal with, because you can say that the Bank of England is... But unless the other banks are publicly owned, government banks, then it does raise a few question marks as to who it is they are accountable to. You could say they should be accountable to their customers, which is what any sort of business in reality would be. But being accountable to their customers, if they mess up and their customers go somewhere else, then generally businesses collapse. But with the banks, instead of allowing them to disappear and new ones be created, whether it be by the government, what's happened is the government has used taxpayers' money to support the banks, to prevent them from crashing and causing a deeper recession, deeper problem in 2008, etc. But as Martin, I think, quite rightly pointed out, what we've not done is we've not got the banks back into not only stability but into regulation from the government, so that these problems will not happen again. And you know, to a great extent, some of what Martin has stated, I completely agree with. The banks have got away with creating a recession and creating a situation for the next recession, and no government, whether it be British, European Union, USA, have actually stood up to the mark and said, no, this we must not allow this to happen. We have to rein the banks in, and we have to do it now. And we do need a government that is going to stand up and do that. I don't think the European Union would ever do it. There is a possibility that if we get the right government in, and I'm not sure a government led by Boris Johnson would be it, but if we get the right government in, then there's a possibility that we can do that in this country. And if we do it in this country and show the way, then hopefully other countries around the world, other governments around the world, will see that it can be done and will hopefully follow suit. And we can hopefully avoid the next 1, 2, 3, 4 recessions that I think Martin would probably agree that are out there that will almost certainly happen. And again, because of the banks and their banking systems, but we do need to work on trying to prevent that from happening.
Well, just before we leave this whole macroeconomic thing, which is in the background, because of course this is in most of the forefronts of most of the people's minds who are voting for Brexit, is from last year. The Telegraph reported that savers will be hit as banks cut their protection on deposits down to £75,000 for the first time since 2008 due to EU rules. But £75,000 protection for your bank deposits, I mean, we're thinking about, you know, a possible crash to come in the future with banks collapsing and the government guaranteeing your £75,000 in there. Really, when 2008 happened and there was a bailout, what the government was doing is effectively it was protecting those with over £75,000 in the bank, and it was also protecting the bank shareholders, Martin.
Well, yeah, I think what's going to happen now, I mean, some people see UKIP as on the right wing of politics, but I think in actual fact we're now seeing a sea change in attitudes towards things like so-called free market economics. That's been happening for years. The pendulum springs in one direction and then it swings back again. I mean, ultimately, for example, it might be the case that we have a nationalised banking system in this country, and it may be with the new powers that we will have. I mean, I remember when I went to Oxford years ago. I'm not allowed to say any more about that because it's too complicated. Anyway,
just get on with it, Martin, yeah?
Well, I was just going to say that when I went for my interview, they said, what do you understand by the term siege economy? Because in the late 1970s, we still had capital controls in Britain. You couldn't leave Britain with more than £1,000 without permission from the government. That was the 1970s. But of course, we'd had full employment from 1945 until the 1970s with the British economy managed by the British government. And if we are going to have independence from international forces, maybe we can start talking about running a nationalised banking industry in Britain, getting rid of all of the tax havens which are British dependent territories and so on. There are possibilities here as well as
there's
dangers.
A very strong argument for treating banking as a utility, making sure it's not there just to make profit, but it's there to enable people to exchange goods and services in the best way possible. Anyway, getting back to reasons why people probably voted Brexit out there, one of the things I've been hearing, Paul, is that a lot of working class people, particularly in sort of built up areas, industrial areas, they voted out because Eastern Europeans are simply taking their jobs.
Well, I think there is an element of that. I think a lot of people have seen that as a perception. And I think what has been happening, certainly over maybe the last sort of 4 or 5 years or so, probably since about 2008 really, I think there has been an awful lot of Eastern Europeans in particular coming to the UK because the standard of living is so much higher that just coming to the UK and even if they just sit on the street corner and beg for a couple of days a week, they're going to earn more money than working 40, 50, 60 hours a week in Romania or Bulgaria, etc. But I think there has been a perceived influx of Eastern Europeans. I was talking to a guy yesterday at the Count, and he was saying that he was in the building trade, and he was saying that he wasn't able to get a job because he only spoke English. And it kind of struck home that well, if we're starting to go down a route where speaking the nation's language is not good enough to be able to get a job in that country, then I think there is something that has gone wrong. I'm not saying that we shouldn't welcome immigrants who are going to be working, but we have nearly 2 million people unemployed in this country. We should be doing more to actually get those people into jobs of some sort and encouraging them to do so.
The problem is here that people are saying you've got to get a job of any sort, even if it's not even paying the bills, if it's very, very minimal pay and conditions that say you can be sacked at any moment, it's 0 hours contract. So the quality of the jobs has also gone down, Paul.
They certainly have, and that again I think has come from the ability for certain businesses to be able to hire in particular Eastern European staff, quite often through Eastern European agencies, so they don't necessarily have to pay UK standard salaries, etc., because they're actually paying an agency in Poland or Romania, and it's that agency that then pays the workers. So even though we have a minimum wage in this country, it doesn't necessarily mean that all of these Eastern European European workers are actually being paid that, because an awful lot of them are here on contracts through Eastern European labour agencies. So they're actually being paid a lot more than they'd get in their own country, but that doesn't mean that they're actually being paid the minimum wage in this country.
Let's also have a look at, and we did touch on this just a bit at the beginning, Martin, what you think of the way that the media has dealt with this issue, this whole campaign over the last few months, and do you think they've done a reasonable job of it?
Tony, the existence of our alternative politics discussion show is a standing two fingers up to the mainstream media, which basically distorts and lies about virtually everything. It always does, it always did, and it's still doing it.
They were calling it wrong last night, weren't they, up until 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock in the evening?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite clear the establishment, if you like, wanted Remain. And that's why, you know, Labour supporters like me, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn basically said, well, I'm not massively enthusiastic about the EU, but it's the best of the worst options. And some of the right wing of the Labour Party think that's not good enough, that he should have been gung-ho for staying in the EU. And you'll find that most people on the left, like me, are not that bothered about being in or out of the EU. We've got other things we want to talk about.
A vote of confidence in Jeremy Corbyn, isn't
Well, there it? Will be, but I think we're going to see upheaval, not just in Britain, but we're, you know, the Greeks are coming back to discuss whether they're going to stay in, and that, of course, then threatens the banking system, and on we go.
But Peter Mandelson virtually calling for his head.
Well, he may do, but he's not going to get it.
Paul, Donald Tusk is saying, well, actually, it doesn't really matter because we've still got 27 countries left in the EU. But he's saying he reckons it could be 7 years, take 7 years to complete this Article 50 extraction, secession from the EU, because no one's ever done it before.
Well, I think the fact that nobody's ever done it before is in itself going to present some issues. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But I think what we need to understand about the European Union is they've got 27 member states now, and they want to keep them. So whether he's right or wrong, what he wants to do is put as much fear as possible into the other 27 states so that there is as little likelihood as possible for any more to want to leave. And I think this is something that is inherently wrong within the European Union, is again they do not listen or understand the people. And I think what we're seeing is the people at the top in the European Union, who are completely unelected, that they are not accountable to the people. And what we've seen for so many years is they just don't listen to the people. And this is where it's all going to go wrong, because the people in the European Union are going to have their say. And you could say that the UK have led the way and has opened the door. It might well be a very difficult and reasonably long process. I don't think it needs to be. I think a lot of people are talking about it, excessive needs. If you think that the Soviet Union broke up and Russia found themselves in a similar position with no trade agreements with any country in the world, and the fact that they're able to renegotiate all bar one of their trade agreements within about 3 months of becoming a sovereign state, and that one remaining one, which was with the United States of America, took just over a year. I think if we look at that as a model of potentially what could happen if people are actually wanting to sit down and actually create a deal. And this is going to be the big question mark. How many of the European Union nations are going to want to sit down and actually create a deal, especially okay. if they themselves might be leaving shortly?
OK, Paul, thanks very much. Time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guest, that's UKIP's candidate for Mayor of Bristol, Paul Turner. After the 6 o'clock news, we look at this subject in greater depth, as well as the Bilderbergs and 9/11.
And on your mobile, BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.